Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is doing really well from his back surgery, and he's planning his return to WLRN. So we're all very happy about that. Well, as I mentioned, many children started a new school year today. For many parents, it's a time of anxiety and fear, especially in today's climate. But for children, it can also cause great anxiety and worry. But how much anxiety is too much, and what are the warning signs? Joining us is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Miami, Jill Ehrenreich-May. She's also the director of their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program. It's known as CAMAT. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, welcome, Dr. Jill Ehrenreich-May.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back. Also with us in the studio, Martha Harris. She's the Administrative Director of the Division of Student Services for my Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Welcome to you, Martha.
Thank you.
And Isabel Rodriguez-Duncan is also with us. She's a licensed clinical social worker and the Program District Chairperson Person of Trust, which is an acronym for To Reach Ultimate Success Together for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to address each of you sometimes I won't. So when I haven't addressed you, if you'll just say your name before you answer to avoid any confusion, because there are three of us in the studio, or four of us in the studio, so to make it clearer. So as I alluded to in the open, in our time of school shootings and omnipresent cameras, surveillance, sometimes metal detectors, dogs, body searches, bullying incidents, pressure to perform. Let me ask each of you if anxiety has become a normal response for both parents and students. Jill?
Well, I think the first thing to remember about anxiety, especially on these first couple of days of school, is that anxiety is a normal response. It's a normal response to uncertainty, to the unknown. And you know, for many children, whether they are transitioning to a new environment today or whether they're going back into an environment that they're more familiar with, there is a certain element of uncertainty that's going to be there for them. And so anxiety in those situations would be expected and would be typical. So these kinds of back-to-school jitters, even in the face of, you know, more persistent or extreme threats that you alluded to, you know, is a normal response on these first couple of days of school.
Okay, and what has been your experience, Isabel?
Well, as Jill mentioned, anxiety is a very normal response to anything that is new. And it's usually a heightened awareness in regards to, again, wanting to really deal with a certain demand that's placed on you. And it is a very normal response, and we'll be talking about it during our show in regards to when it is, and it goes beyond what the normal and typical response is to something new. What we're proud to report is that Miami-Dade County Public Schools, is all of our school systems across the nation, are the safest place for our students to be. So we're very happy to report that.
Okay. And Martha,
sure.
Did you want to add something?
I do. I have to echo what Isabel said, in that students can come to Miami-Dade County Public Schools feeling safe, knowing that we have a host of programs and initiatives to help them not only with the back-to-school jitters, but also as they transition through the year with the different challenges they have.
Well, let's look first at some of the signs and symptoms of what we are calling normal anxiety. What does that look like, and how long does that generally last?
So this is Jill. I can address that. So for kids today who are experiencing some back-to-school jitters, parents probably knew that before this morning, because they were probably having some symptoms of that last week or last night. They may have been feeling some worry or expressing some worry about what's going to happen at school. They may have been feeling a little bit physically sick. You know, they might have had a little bit of a nervous stomach, or even thrown up in some cases, or had some trouble sleeping. And for some kids, there may have been some reluctance this morning as they were trying to enter school, especially if this was the first time that they were entering school for kindergarten or for preschool, or it was a new environment for them. So those are some of the things that they might have seen over the last couple of days or this morning in particular.
Okay, so Isabel or Martha, speak to what you do for this normal anxiety for children. So somebody comes in and, you know, they're either having these physical symptoms, you know, what do you do?
Most definitely. This is Isabel. As Jill was mentioning, when it comes to something that is a normal expression of anxiety, it's very temporary. That's one of the key indicators of that. It is temporary. It lasts for a little bit of time. What we do in our school district, and we're very proud of, is that we have our schools are really have opening of schools procedures. We have our staff standing outside to welcome our students, to give them a big hug and let them know that we are going to have a fantastic year. We're there also to speak to our parents and answer any questions or concerns that they might have about this new school year. So it's a very positive experience, even for our students that may have been woeful this morning in the sense of that summer is over, that they just go into our regular schools, meet their friends, and it's a very positive experience.
Did you want to add something, Martha?
Sure, I agree. And also, just in case, if the student does find the transition troubling throughout the day, we do have, of course, our school guidance counselors, our trust counselors, and our school social workers. So there are personnel on hand at the school to help ease the process.
Can we talk, describe trust a little more around? I see it's, you know, the acronym for To Reach Ultimate Success Together. What is that actually? What is that program?
Most definitely. The program was piloted in 1988, so it's about 26 years in the making. They're basically master's level mental health professionals that are in our secondary schools. And they focus on a truly prevention as well as intervention. Their focus is to prevent and to address any concerning behaviors, mental health issues, substance use, and abuse. It's our prevention component also in regards to violence prevention and addressing really any concerns that are of that nature, providing individual group family counseling and such.
Have you all found that I'm just thinking of parents and children who admit and express their fears openly as opposed to those who maybe deny them or feel shame about them. Do you see both quite frequently, and how do each of them fare?
This is Jill. Well, I think one thing to understand about children who are anxious or shy is that they're not always very forthcoming about what it is that they're feeling. You know, sometimes one of the very first things that we'll ask parents to do is to really create an environment in which they are creating opportunities for their child to talk with them, where they're expressing empathy and specifically asking about how the day went, both positives and negatives, and expressing a lot of empathy about how things are going, whether, you know, for example, if things are feeling challenging to them during that time, and not necessarily expecting that the child's going to run to them with those concerns. And I think the same thing is a challenge, you know, I would assume for teachers as well, because these aren't always the kids who are obviously in distress or who are causing a large disruption in the classroom. Sometimes these kids are the more withdrawn ones or the ones who are just asking for a bathroom pass more often, and it's not really clear what's going on. So some of those things, you know, are important to establish with the child very, very clearly early on.
I found myself wondering about a gender breakdown. Wouldn't it be, I mean, to me, it would seem that girls would be more readily expressive of their feelings and more able to cry or whatever than boys.
Well, I think one thing to understand about anxiety just in general is that it's extraordinarily common across both genders.
Okay. Yeah.
That, you know, anywhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 10 children during their developmental years have a clinical anxiety disorder. So it is extraordinarily common.
1 in 10 children?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really, really common. We sometimes refer to it as the common cold of mental illness. It's that common. You know, as time goes on, we do start to see a gender discrepancy with some anxiety disorders, not all. And it could be because girls are more expressive about mm-hmm. their feelings, or because they tell people how it is that they're feeling, that they want help, or that they're in need of help. But we do see, as they age into adolescence, some gender discrepancies where girls have experienced some anxiety disorders more frequently than boys.
And Isabel, did you want to add something to
Yes, I wanted to add one of the things that we have been implementing since last school year is that we have implemented the typical or troubled education program, which is an evidence-based program, awareness program from the American Psychiatric Foundation. And its focus has been on secondary schools, middle schools, as well as senior high schools, to teach our faculty to be able to identify what are potential signs and symptoms of what is a child that may be, what is typically expected as far as age development. Age, and then what is perhaps some sign of or symptom of a child that may be troubled. A student, for example, that may be aggressive or oppositional, they may think this is just a conduct issue. It may be a symptom of a child that's maybe dealing with something that's going on in the home, a mood issue, anxiety issue, and it shows differently, and it may show differently in boys versus girls.
Right. I wonder how often it's the parent's anxiety that is almost transferred to the child. Do you find that quite a bit, that you don't know sometimes if it's the child or the parents that have kind of, you know, caused it in the child?
Mrs. Jell, what we do know is that children of parents who have an anxiety disorder are more likely to have an anxiety disorder themselves. So we know that there is a risk from a genetic perspective for that to occur. But we also know that the environment plays a big role, and that parents who are quite anxious or who convey messages that the situation could be threatening, may engender a more anxious reaction in their child, or importantly, a reaction in which the child starts to avoid the situation because they're feeling some level of distress. The parent may reinforce that or encourage that, often by accident. I think most parents are well-meaning and don't want their child to avoid school.
Sure.
When they see that their child has experienced this discomfort, it's very natural to want to protect that child, to pull them back from that environment and help them to feel safe. Whereas, unfortunately, that's exactly what actually increases anxiety over time.
You mean avoidance?
Yes, exactly. The avoidance increases anxiety over time rather than decreases it, because the child never really gets to learn whether the thing that they were worried about was in fact threatening or dangerous after
real.
All.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isabel?
I completely agree. In a certain sense, the parent experiences the anxiety through the child and wants to save the child. So it's almost reinforcing to the parent, as well as also causing a secondary gain with the student, and not allowing them to really be able to implement some coping strategies so that they know at the end, I can handle it. And that's perhaps the core that we're looking at, is to really make sure that it's not about saving the child from initial discomfort, that life is about adaptation and providing those skills and the opportunity again
to work through it. We're speaking about anxiety, going back to school anxiety, but anxiety in general in children, with Martha Harris and Isabel Rodriguez Duncan from Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and Jill Erin Reichmay is from the University of Miami Department of Psychology and their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. We're going to open the phones and emails and tweets, so stay with us. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, we're speaking about back-to-school anxiety and clinical anxiety with Jill Erin Reichmay of the University of Miami and director of their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program, known as CAMAT. Also, Martha Harris is the administrative director of the Division of Student Services for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And Isabel Rodriguez Duncan is a licensed clinical social worker and the Miami-Dade County Public School District chairperson for To Reach Ultimate Success Together, Trust. If you have questions or comments, if you're a parent and with a question, if you're a student, I guess you're in school, unless you decided it was too much anxiety. Anyway, whatever your question, comment, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org, you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Jill, how long have you specialized in anxiety disorders in children and adolescents?
Really since I completed my graduate training. So, you know, over these last 10 years, I've gained increasing specialty training working with anxious children and have been running the clinic where we specialize in providing evidence-based treatment services for children and adolescents with anxiety disorders for, since 2008.
So have you seen in those 10 years a large uptick?
It's hard to say for sure. Again, you know, we know that, as I mentioned at sort of the top of the show, anxiety is such a normal experience. So, you know, we have a pretty large base of children all the time who unfortunately need some level of clinical services. We certainly see that the types of worries that kids have shift. They shift with the news. They shift with technology. They literally hear shift with the wind, in the sense of when hurricane season comes.
Right.
We have the content of the worry changes. We're not always clear whether there's an increase dramatically in the frequency. There has been some small uptick over the last several years, but we don't know if that's going to be something that's going to continue to increase or whether that's something that is just a temporary shift in the numbers.
And what about you, Isabel and Martha? Have you seen any kind of an increase?
This is Isabel. I echo what Jill was saying in the sense of the type. I think that what we're seeing more as far as an increase, because again, our population is not a clinical population. Traditionally, it is the general population of students. We do see a change, and we have seen a shift in the types of worries, in the sense of we used to never, because it wasn't in existence, certain technologies. Cyber safety issues were trying to assist our students to really make wise decisions when they make when they use technology, cyberbullying, and those kinds of things. I don't think that it's necessarily an increase. I think that there's greater awareness of anxiety, and I think there's a greater awareness also of all the issues that may perpetuate the symptom of anxiety.
Let's talk about Martha. Did you want to add something?
I do agree with Isabel. My joy in addressing it is that the district comes ready to embrace our children that are struggling with anxiety, ready to help the families that are struggling with anxiety so that they won't feel alone and so that we can help them through the process.
Do you ever have situations, I just was, you know, going, thinking about where one parent, like let's say the father, says, you know, be strong, and you know, they're, you know, kind of telling them to just ignore, and then the mother who wants to be more protective. Is that sometimes more confusing for the kid, where you have parents at odds with one another?
And this is Isabel. I think that whenever there's like a dual message issue taking place in the home, it can cause that conflict can cause anxiety. One of the things that we do as far as the Division of Student Services in Miami-Dade is that we don't wait until an issue takes place. We put in place prevention strategies. And one of the things that we work with our students and our staff alike is to promote those protective factors that that really protect our students from danger from themselves and danger from the outside environment. So we provide additional, for example, through the TRUST curriculum, substance use prevention strategies, how to deal with conflicts, how to use technology. One of the things that's an issue with technology is that children are exposed to a lot more than they used to. Back when it wasn't in, now something happens in this part of the world, everybody saw it.
Exactly.
And sees it repeatedly. So I think that our students are much more savvy, much more mature than we were when we were younger. And we attempt to provide them with the skills to be able to manage this new world.
So, for example, when, God forbid, or when there have been shooting incidents, what mode do you go into?
Well, again, it's not something that we go into, and we strive in within Miami-Dade County, to really promote and be proactive. We have built in, for example, one of the partnerships that we have is with our own school police. We have the Campus Shield, See Something, Say Something program. We have the Be Safe Anonymous reporting system. We drill into our students since they're very young that the message that it's not about tattletaling, it's not about snitching, it's about taking responsibility, and that everything and safety in general is a shared responsibility. That is something that is partnered from the school to the community, the parents, the students, society together. And that's how we really move forward.
Well, we're going to get to some more of those programs and go into them more in depth. But I'd like now to define clinical anxiety so, you know, at least our listeners can understand how it differs from normal anxiety. And so if you'll do that, Jill, Erin Reshmi.
Sure. So, you know, these next couple of weeks is going to be a time where we expect that kids, as we talked about, will experience some level of anxiety very typically. When we're looking at children and when we're evaluating children in our clinic who have more severe symptoms of anxiety, there are a couple of key differences that we see. One is that the symptoms are persistent. They're going on much longer than you would sort of anticipate. So well beyond this first couple of weeks of school. And oftentimes there's been incidents in the past where they were experiencing those symptoms as well. The second is that they sometimes are developmentally inappropriate. So in other words, they're having symptoms that you wouldn't necessarily expect for their age. So separation anxiety well beyond a time where you would expect that they would have adjusted to the idea that they're safe, that their parents safe, and so on. The other is that it's out of proportion to the situation at hand. And we see that sometimes with feelings of social exclusion, for example, that the child is having social anxiety symptoms well beyond what is actually happening in the school environment. And that can be a little bit tricky, of course, because sometimes when you are socially anxious, your skills may not be the very best. And so that might create situations with peers where there could be some level of social exclusion. But finally, the most important thing that we look for is impairment. The idea that these anxiety symptoms are keeping the child from achieving at school or having friendships that are meaningful or lasting. And oftentimes the impairment occurs, you know, beyond the child's own distress in the family environment where the kinds of avoidance behaviors are being seen by the parents or being accommodated by the parents and really causing some conflict or strife in the household as well.
How can you be sure that when children are having physical manifestations of anxiety and fear that they're not indicative of a physical illness?
Well, one of the very first things when we hear about a child who is having, say, persistent headaches or persistent stomach aches is we do ask when we're screening those children, have they been to their medical professional? Have they been to their pediatrician? And have they made sure that this is not the manifestation of another illness? And you know, to be honest, most of the time, parents bring these concerns to their pediatricians first. So they often have brought them there and the pediatrician has said, you know, I don't really see anything physically wrong with your child. Or they've even been referred sometimes to specialists and had testing to make sure that they're fine if they're more extreme symptoms. And then they come to us because the clinician who's seen them or the physician who's seen them thinks, well, you know, I think this might be anxiety. So it's time to address it through those mechanisms instead.
And you, Isabel, when do you send a child to their, I mean, sometimes do you go to their pediatrician to make sure it's not a physical illness? And when do you send them for outside help versus therapy within the school?
Most definitely, I'll answer that. In regards to your first question, in the sense of when do we send them to the physician, we're constantly, as I mentioned to you before, really working with our faculty and our parents in really identifying early warning signs of issues. And then we have our student, our individuals that are part of our Division of Student Services, school counselors, school social workers. Sometimes we're able to identify a pattern of behavior. Let's say the stomach ache only happens in Mrs. Duncan's class.
Okay.
You know, and we're seeing like that. So that might be, give us a clue that perhaps something is going on in math class. Maybe it's anxiety because of math performance that's causing this issue. We really partner with the parents and really explain to them that the first thing that we always do, whether we're an outside entity or within the school, is to check our medical issues to see whether or not is there any organic cause for these issues. But a lot of times when it's something related to anxiety, you can identify to some degree a precursor, what has been the antecedent. And usually you'll see a pattern forming. One of the great things about working with our students as a school counseling professional is to be able to see them in their natural environment, and you'll be able to track when it's happening. When are they wanting to go to the clinic to speak to the school counselor, to the school nurse? What's really happening? What happened in classing, and being able to communicate with the professor. One of the things that we do is we do partner very much so with our community agencies. If it's an issue that really, because within Miami-Dade County Public Schools, we do not provide treatment for mental health issues, but we do focus on access, helping children access their education. And many times we partner with our outside agencies. Let's say I'm a school social worker in the school site. I will partner with Jill at the site, and we'll say, what is her treatment plan? Let's work on coping strategies here so we can assist the child, coach the child within the school setting so that they are successful, and then they can review their status. And we also then have the ability so that if the child is, let's say it's the degree of anxiety is so much so that we're having psychiatric medications being used as well, we can partner with the doctor in the sense of saying these are the effects that we're seeing with the student. It's being the child is perhaps too sedated, or he's not feeling well. So it's a very important partnership.
And we're going to talk about treatments as we go along here. And Martha, did you want to add something there?
Thank you. Do you know what I have to stress is so important is parents need to talk to their school counselor. Parents need to talk to their child's teacher, because it's very difficult at the school site to assist the parent and to assist the child if we don't know.
Right.
If the parents decide, oh, no, I'm going to try to handle this myself. And I must say that allowing us to work with the family, allowing us to work with the student, we will together get better results.
Better success.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're speaking about anxiety in children as they go back to school, clinical anxiety, normal anxiety, with Martha Harris from and Isabel Rodriguez Duncan from Miami-Dade County Public Schools and Jill Erin Reich May from the University of Miami. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls, 1-800-743-9576, or radio at WLRN.org is our email. Welcome back to Topical Currents for Monday. Bonnie Berman speaking with Jill Erin Reich May of the University of Miami and the director of their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program. Martha Harris, the administrative director of the Division of Student Services for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And Isabel Rodriguez Duncan is a licensed clinical social worker and the MDCPS district chairperson for TRUST. We have an emailer here with an interesting point. It's Andrew. He says, he asks about the anxiety related to athletic programs in the school system, from the locker rooms to the baseball fields. He says, as a 50-year-old man, he recalls pretending to be sick to avoid school due to athletic environment, and gym was scheduled on that day. And it was so humiliating for a boy of 8, and it led him to avoiding all competitive sports even to this day. He says he realized it's changed in the last 50 years, but where does Miami-Dade County sit in regarding that?
Well, I'll speak to it in the general sense. One of the things that is, I think, very strong about Miami-Dade County Public Schools, we have a phenomenal school social work program. And students that are really exhibiting a certain pattern of truancy and or absences, we do send our school social worker out, as well as our school counselor within the school, to be able to address what are the reasons or the underlying reasons that a student is avoiding school. And it could be for a variety of different issues. One of the things that we also do is that perhaps in a certain sense, I believe that individuals kind of focus on students that are low performing, not in athletics, as the ones that may need additional assistance. When we look at our high performing athletes, when we look at our high-performing students, a great deal of anxiety and other issues may be related. And what ends up happening is with these very sophisticated students is that they're able to mask better, that their everything fear. Is okay.
Right.
And that in itself could be a risk factor for some of these students.
Jill?
Yeah, I wanted to just add, I think that those kinds of fears that Andrew expressed are really common at all levels, really. I think most children probably have, even good athletes have, you know, maybe even especially good athletes have fears about their performance in those areas. And they're very common amongst the children who we see with clinical anxiety concerns as well. And I think one thing that's important to address with regard to those fears is, are they realistic or are they really, again, out of proportion to the reality of the situation? If the person is in some ways exaggerating those fears in their mind, then working with them to do what we call reappraise or to go over the situation and really look to see whether there's accurate information about either their performance or, you know, or the perhaps the reactions of others to their performance, and or whether they're really withdrawing from those situations ahead of time without really knowing whether or not they could be more successful in the situation, or even if they're not going to be successful in the situation, whether they could tolerate it. You know, learning to deal with anxiety in some ways is a very empowering experience. Learning to know that you could be okay even if you don't do well in a situation is a life lesson that is important for children to learn and does affect how they handle situations going forward. So, you know, you could avoid that. You know, there are ways to probably get out of gym if you really, really wanted to. But, you know, learning to deal with it is something that could be a growth experience.
Martha?
Yes, I think everyone has felt that way. I have to say, as a school principal and school site administrator for many years, you come across students with very specific concerns regarding sports, regarding their performance, that they can't run as fast as others. And that is, again, essential where the school counselor plays a role, where the teacher takes note and can involve the school counselor to help that child overcome that barrier.
Does an anxiety order, is it usually accompanied by other disorders?
Yes, this is Jill. Anxiety disorders are very commonly what we call comorbid, or they co-occur with other anxiety disorders, most of all. So for example, if you have social anxiety disorder, it's very common to have, say, generalized anxiety disorder, which is a disorder where you worry excessively, you know, or to have separation anxiety disorder and maybe obsessive compulsive disorder. These things oftentimes co-occur, but they can co-occur with other things as well that can become more concerning, like depression. Later, substance abuse is a concern as well. For people who try to sort of self-medicate to reduce their own anxiety. So comorbidities are actually a way in which more severe problems can start to occur over time, because I think an important point that we haven't made so far is that anxiety doesn't just tend to go away on its own. It really is something that can persist without effective treatment. And so those other comorbidities blossom because it's kind of going unfettered and it's becoming more frustrating and upsetting for the child over time.
Well, let's talk about some of the treatments. Now, I know you use this cognitive behavioral therapy, and we're going to ask you to tell us more about and how it differs from conventional therapy, but do you also use psychopharmacology, drugs?
We don't use them in our clinic. We do partner with a number of wonderful child psychiatrists in our community when we feel like the child could benefit either from what we call dual therapy, where they're going to be doing cognitive behavioral therapy and receiving a medication therapy, or they're already on those. What we know about the evidence base for these treatments is that these kinds of medications, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs most commonly, or cognitive behavioral therapy, have about somewhere around a 60 to 70% efficacy rate on their own. So 60 to 70% of children who use one of those therapies for an extended amount of time will get better. But when they're used in combination, there's a subset of kids who respond even, you know, more beneficially. So it brings the efficacy rates up to sometimes near 80% when they're combined.
And describe now cognitive behavioral therapy and how it's different from conventional therapy.
Sure. Cognitive behavioral therapy is often thought of as a short-term, present-focused psychotherapy. It has elements of a traditional psychotherapy. You're forming a relationship with the child and the family. You're doing good assessment to understand that family and their child's concerns. During the course of what is often 12 to 16 sessions, what we do is focus first on education about anxiety, that it's normal, that it's a natural reaction to the environment, that it's ultimately harmless, feels very uncomfortable, but it's harmless.
Right.
We do work to try to make the child more aware of their body symptoms of anxiety, their heart beating fast, their breathing going fast, and how to adjust those things, or at least get used to them. And we work with, obviously, the cognitive strategies, so that kind of reappraisal or cognitive restructuring that we talked about earlier, where we're trying to think about what are the actual information about the things you're worried about.
Versus the fear. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Versus letting the fear kind of go more unfettered. And then finally, the behavioral part, really, of cognitive behavioral therapy, a lot of people think is the most effective part, which is gradually exposing the child to the environments and the situations that they've been avoiding. So, you know, that may mean, you know, making a list of things, of ways to get back into a situation slowly but surely. Some children can do that quickly. Some people need to do that over a longer amount of time. But most people think that if there's a cure in CBT, that it's the elements that involve the child actually going back and doing the things that they're fearing.
That they're afraid of.
Yeah.
Isabel?
In the sense of the focus, perhaps as a school counselor or someone on the school site level, we use many of the same techniques that mm-hmm. you find in CBT. We help the child really identify what are perhaps one of those irrational belief systems. Many times what you see with anxiety disorders is a fatalistic kind of element to the thought system, that if I come into this crowd, this is going to happen. It's usually very much larger than possible. It's kind of like a very, it's either impossible or very unlikely that that would occur. So it's really helping the child kind of, what are those irrational thoughts that you're experiencing? Let's write them down. Let's write them down. Let's go ahead and say, let's think it through. What would happen? What could
What's
you
the
do?
Worst
What's
thing
the worst could... thing that could happen? And how could you manage it? Really working on building coping strategies, reinforcing relaxation, different relaxation techniques. We also will provide also additional feedback in regards to identifying what are potential triggers to mm-hmm. this, what was happening before, because part of it is also to help them become more aware of what's happening in the environment. So it's not, I can control it better if I can know what's happening.
Right.
And then I can plan also. So if all the time I have to speak in front of the class, I get nervous. When I have this oral presentation, these are the things I'm going to present. This is how what I'm going to do beforehand to practice to be able to reduce my level of arousal so I can manage the situation.
Do you find that more students are homeschooling because of anxiety? Has there been an increase in that? It just was a thought of mine.
I mean, what we look at our educational options, we are seeing parents really taking advantage of different educational options. Mm-hmm. And again, every parent has to make the decision that's in the best interest of the child. As a clinician, at times, I feel mixed feelings in regards to having homeschooling, in regards to anxiety, because it seems to perpetuate the pathology. It
For
seems
the very
to reinforcing,
reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it gives the message to the child that you can't handle it.
Right.
In a certain sense. And then there is no desire to reenter, and all those things that are, because perhaps there are some elements in the school environment that are anxiety producing, but there are others that are very positive to the child. So it kind of takes them away from all that.
Mm. We're speaking about anxiety in children on their first day back to school, clinical and otherwise, with Jill Ehrenreich-May, an associate professor of psychology at U of M and director of their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program. Martha Harris and Isabel Rodriguez-Duncan are both with Miami-Dade County Public Schools. We're going to take one more short break, and we'll be back. Welcome back to today's Topic Occurrence. Thanks for joining us, Bonnie Berman, with Jill Erin Reichmay from the University of Miami. Isabel Rodriguez Duncan and Martha Harris are both with Miami-Dade County Public Schools. I was going to ask you, Isabel and Martha, about this sexual minority network. Before I do, though, I have an email from Ed who says, one source of anxiety in school in the 1980s and earlier was the stress of being an LGBT minority. With the changes in society, is this now less of an issue, or is it still difficult for some kids? Isabel?
It is. It's a process. It's a process. Even though we have gone through leaps and bounds, it used to be if you take the example of media coverage, let's say a television show, you would never see potentially a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender individual that's an actor that would be coming out. And now we see more and more. So mm-hmm. our students are much more accepting, but the internal process is a process. The coming out to yourself and then coming out to your family. Our Sexual Minority Network is a phenomenal program that Miami-Dade has in practice over 21 years. And we provide, we have a Sexual Minority Network liaisons in every single one of the secondary schools, middle and senior high school. Our school counselors serve as a liaison in the elementary level. Their focus, they are provided for professional development trainings to really make sure that we're building programs within our schools that are inclusive programs to really reinforce the main purpose of Miami-Dade County is really providing a safe learning environment for all of our students and really making sure that we provide a gamut of services from individual, group, and family when we need to, that we also have established gay straight alliance networks or clubs that are similar to that so that our students feel really part of an important part of our schools.
And what about bullying, Martha?
As many people know, Miami-Dade County Public Schools does have an extensive bullying program. And what we do try to do, beginning in the elementary years, is teach our students, prevent it from happening. Teach our students that it's not being a snitch when you're telling the teacher if someone is bothering your friend or bothering you. And I think by starting in the younger grades, we are going to see over time that this program will have positive results.
And did you want to add something, Jill, about this, about the minority and the bullying?
Well, just in regard to the bullying, I just wanted to really praise the Miami-Dade County Public Schools because I think that they've also been a partner with us at the University of Miami in doing innovative research with regard to myself and my colleague, Dr. Annette LaGreca, really looking even at new programs to help adolescents who have anxiety or depressive symptoms and have been victims of peer victimization. They've partnered with us in a grant from the National Institutes of Health to really work on trying to find new programs to assist. So I think they're really trying to think about new ways to help children who've experienced these kinds of difficult situations, which often are co-occurring with anxiety disorders. You know, we see many children who come in to see us in our clinic who are either questioning their sexual status or whether they are experiencing bullying because of that or because of other things. It's just extraordinarily common in our population. It doesn't necessarily cause anxiety or vice versa, but there are really co-occurring concerns there as well.
And what is this Be Safe Anonymous program? You mentioned that.
The Be Safe Anonymous reporting system has been in place for several years now. One of the things that is of a struggle, I think, with parents and educators alike is really helping students break the silence. And there is normal anxiety and caution in coming forth and saying, I'm seeing something that I don't feel comfortable with and I'm scared to come forward. Mm-hmm. I want to keep myself anonymous. So it's a way for them to report situations that are potentially unsafe. The Be Safe Anonymous reporting system is completely confidential and anonymous. We have three different ways to make a report. One is through besafe.dadeschools.net. It's an actual profile that the person can provide any information that they have about the situation. And it's something that's an unsafe situation or a child that might need assistance. So we also have the text component as well. Children can send in the tip through text or a phone call. The tips are delivered directly to our school police 24 hours, 7 days a week. And it also is delivered to the Division of Student Services, to Ms. Harris, actually. And if it's a situation that really needs both offices to respond, both offices respond and have the immediate information. If it's something that is more counseling related, we're able to deploy services as needed.
So does somebody check out every one of these complaints? Is that it? I mean, how do you know about the veracity of some of them if somebody wanted to just get somebody in trouble, let's say?
Well, what we do with all of these reports, whether it's a bullying report that comes into our office, we have to assume in the very beginning that it's an accurate information, mm-hmm. and we do everything that we can. And again, the nature of the Be Safe Anonymous reporting system is not to get students in trouble. It's to get them help. And that's the main core response.
Right, exactly. Martha, do you want to add something to that?
I think Isabel summed up the program very well. I think it goes back to the idea that we can't help students unless we know. As school counselors, as administrators, if students don't tell us, we're not able to provide the variety of assistance that we have.
And so you have several outlets and several means of them being able to express whatever it is that they need to express. We have a question from Richard. He says his five-year-old daughter had repeated but very brief episodes of crying in kindergarten, lasting 1 minute or less, and revolved around making a mistake with a math problem or separation anxiety, and she had demonstrated no impairment otherwise. However, teacher suggested we have her undergo therapy, which she's been doing. However, my feeling is that it's simply a temporary maturational issue. Is it a reasonable thought? What would be the indications that it's something that requires short or long-term therapy? Jill, Erin, Reshme?
So, you know, I obviously don't know all the particulars about this, about Richard's daughter, but I think it's important to understand that there are developmental changes in how a child presents anxiety, and there are some cases in which the symptoms will seem to shift or morph over time. But I think one thing that's important to understand about very significant anxiety, you know, again, that persistent, developmentally inappropriate, out of proportion kind of anxiety, impairing anxiety that we talked about, is that it doesn't, again, just go away. It sometimes will shift. It can shift from, say, separation anxiety to social anxiety, mm-hmm. or generalized anxiety over time. It may not have the exact same form, but that in and of itself is really a good indicator that this is a more persistent problem that the child is experiencing, that it's, you know, it's not just something transient. You know, oftentimes when it is something more temporary, it's linked to a very particular stressor or a very particular type of situation in school, and when that situation goes away, the anxiety
goes away
entirely. And that's a more, that happens, of course, and I think that's a more common experience. But for children with multiple anxiety concerns, you know, the sort of short-term therapy that we were discussing, the cognitive behavioral therapy, is often a good option, particularly once children reach, say, 6 or 7, and you know that this problem is not going away. It's really persisted through that time. We often will start therapy around that time.
Okay. And Kevin tweets, speaking from experience, this is to what you were saying, Martha and Isabel, just talking about my anxiety as an openly gay man made things easier internally. So
that is one of the things that we work with all of our students, is really helping them to learn to speak and to know that there are individuals in our school buildings that they can speak to confidentially and they can bare their soul to if they need to. That in itself, just being able to speak of it, to have someone validate where you're coming from, to help you really learn about yourself, is so valuable.
Well, we want to thank all of you. Martha Harris is the Administrative Director of the Division of Student Services for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Martha, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And for staying. And Isabel Rodriguez-Duncan is a licensed clinical social worker and the Miami-Dade County Public Schools District Chairperson for TRUST, which is an acronym for To Reach Ultimate Success Together. Thank you, Isabel.
Thank you for having us.
And Jill Erin Reishme is an Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Miami. She's the director of their Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program, which is CAMAT, C-A-M-A-T. And I believe the website for that, Jill, is www.miami.edu/ child anxiety.
That's correct. All one word.
All one word. And we'll have a link to that on our website.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for all of you being here, and for thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and at our Facebook page, facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's program is an Actor Service pet care program with veterinarian Dr. Ian Kupke and animal behaviorist Adele Miedes. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a great one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.